Hey everybody, welcome to episode 11 of GRCast. I'm your host Joe Ryan, and joining me in the studio today we have Charles Battersby.
Hello.
Well, I think we may as well do what we always do, Charles. What have you been playing?
I've been playing Animal Crossing: A New Leaf, of course.
It's strange. I've always wanted to play an Animal Crossing game, and I never have. I don't know how I've avoided it this long.
Well, I'm one of those poor addicts who's been playing it right from the beginning. So when the first game came out for the GameCube, I was right there with my old-fashioned Game Boy Advance hooked up to the GameCube through that old cable for you grizzled old gamers who remember the days when you could plug your Game Boy into your GameCube. We used to do that with Animal Crossing, which would let you take your character from the actual GameCube game over into a little mini island that only existed on your Game Boy Advance. And of course, eventually, Nintendo wised up and they just made a mobile version of the damn game so that you wouldn't have to sit there on your couch collecting imaginary fruit and digging up imaginary fossils for hours in front of your TV. And, you know, once the game hit the DS, that's when it really took off, because, you know, it's the kind of thing that it's really well suited to just playing in little bursts when you're on the go, like on the DS or the 3DS.
Is that similar to the sort of freemium city building games that you get on like iPhone, where you don't sit there and play it for hours, you just check in every 2-3 hours or whatever? Or is it more intensive of a game being on a console like that?
Yeah, it's very similar to the casual city-building games and to a lot of, iPhone-style mini-games. With Animal Crossing, it's not intended for you to pop in every couple of hours. There are more daily events. So if you check in with your town maybe once every morning and then, you know, just later again in the day, you can harvest your crops and, you know, search for all the resources and do your economy. And it's designed so that different things will happen at different points during the day. So if you check in early in the morning and then check in late at night, you'll get a slightly different experience. And you can run around the town collecting insects. You have a little butterfly net that you use to capture bugs. And some of the bugs only come out at night. Some characters are more active late at night, and others are more active very early in the morning.
It sounds interesting. I would like to try the new 3DS one at some point, but I don't know if that'll ever actually happen.
It's highly recommended, especially if you are someone that has a long commute or expects to be out and about a lot and, you know, can pop in to just play it for half an hour a couple times a day. And, you know, for those of you who don't know what the Animal Crossing games are, they are an adorably childlike, cute game where you're a human child in a town full of friendly anthropomorphic animals. And you have very simple little adventures. You do basic role play, fetch quest kind of games. You in the new game, you're the mayor of a town, and you can help design the way the town is shaped. You can plant crops. And there are tons of fishing games, tons of mini games like fishing or catching bugs or digging up fossils. And, they have the appearance of being a child's game, but for grown-ups, they're still a lot of fun.
Nice. I will check it out at some point. I think my kids might be sort of interested in it, too, if I got one of the console versions, maybe one of the older ones. Is there a version coming to Wii U? Is that something they've planned?
I haven't heard about that. The one that just came out for the 3DS, that's something that's been out for Japan for a long time, and it just hit America. So it's very likely that they have one in the works for Wii U. It's such a long-standing franchise, I'd be surprised if they don't come out with a Wii U version. Oh, and yes, I'm sure your kids will love it.
Oh. Yeah, I'm not saying I wouldn't like it.
Dad,
I'm just trying
give us the 3DS.
I'm just trying to get them interested, which is the reason I'll be purchasing Disney Infinity later on this very year. I'm hoping I like it too, but as long as they like it.
I like it.
Well, what else have you got?
Well, I managed to dip my toe in the Final Fantasy XIV A Realm Reborn beta test that ran last weekend.
Matt was getting in on that, too. He seemed kind of excited to get in on it, but I don't remember hearing if he was madly in love with it or anything.
Well, just about everyone that I've talked to has really enjoyed it. I'm one of the players that played a little bit of the original, and I didn't have such a big problem with it. I jumped in later on in the development process, right when they were about to shut down the original version of the game and switch over to A Realm Reborn. And, you know, I thought it was a competent MMO. I didn't think it was the disaster that the hardcore fans thought it was. And with the new version, you know, it's we've only had a little bit of experience with it, but the new version does seem very good. They've you know, literally destroyed their world in a story based, you know, in the storyline of the original game, and now, you know, they completely recreated it. If you're a new player, you'll be introduced to an entirely new world with a whole new set of, you know, intro missions to get you up to speed on the world.
So. What has changed about the gameplay that made people okay with it now when they weren't before?
Well, you know, I didn't really dig too deeply into the original or into the new one. So in terms of mechanics, I'm still just getting, you know, still just getting used to what the game is like myself. So I can't really say, you know, what, you know, intense, you know, details have been changed about the game.
Huh. I know Matt was saying that he thought, I'm sure he played 14 also, and he thought it was a little bit more World of Warcraft now, which in one way I suppose is a good thing, but it seems like these days there's a lot of people who are trying to find the next thing. They're moving on from World of Warcraft and going, okay, I'm tired of just pressing buttons 1 through 4 every 15 seconds for 3 hours. I would like to do something else now, please.
Yeah, that's what a lot of people are trying to do, more action-centered MMOs. But with Final Fantasy XIV, there's still some old-timey mechanics behind it. You're still going to be scrolling through text and not dealing with, you know, the interactive cutscenes that you'd get in something like Knights of the Old Republic or The Secret World.
Huh. I think as long as it's Final Fantasy, you know, there's going to be people playing it, right? I mean, you put Final Fantasy name on there and you've got customers.
Yeah, unfortunately, that is true. You can only do that so many times before you're eventually going to start tarnishing the franchise's reputation. And, you know, if you just call it, you know, Final Fantasy, buy it, damn it, then you're going to lose that customer base. It may take a whole generation of, you know, game players before it happens. But, you know, Square Enix knows that they have to keep producing quality content. And I think that's why they ended up trashing the original Final Fantasy XIV and rebuilding it entirely, was so that they could salvage the reputation of the franchise.
If they want to salvage the reputation of that franchise, they need to stop the guys who continue putting out mobile versions of their games or making new mobile games like Final Fantasy All the Bravest, that are nothing but a cash grab, which is basically not even a game at all.
Yeah, I think that gamers have hit a point where they realize that if you buy a Final Fantasy game for a mobile device, if it doesn't have tactics in the title, and if it isn't a remake of an older Final Fantasy game, then, you know, people are learning, just don't buy them.
Yeah, that's probably the safer bet.
Yeah, if it doesn't have tactics or a Roman numeral in the name, then, you know, just stay away. And I've also been playing a little bit of Arma 3. I, you know, got in the alpha, and they just recently switched over to the beta. And, you know, this, for people who don't know what the Arma series is, it's most famous because of the DayZ mod that turned it into a zombie apocalypse. But it's actually a hardcore, super realistic series of military simulations. And 3 has just come out, adding in a bunch of new features. And it's been in this long alpha, finally hit a beta, and eventually the game will arrive. But people who pre-bought it have been able to play it in the early stages of development for the last few months.
Is this the game or the series that they consider to be a recruitment tool for the U.S. military, or am I thinking of something else?
I think you're thinking of America's Army.
Ah, yes, that's right.
That was the free-to-play game where everything in it is very realistic, and reloading your 249 takes, you know, 30 seconds while you watch a really slow animation of a guy loading in this belt of ammunition. And with the Arma series, there's a little of that, but, you know, it's a commercial product, not a recruitment tool, and focuses on realism, and also once you've played through the early missions, players have a free roaming ability where they can just drive drive around this big section of Russian territory and engage in missions, or just do Grand Theft Auto style mayhem driving around.
So there's a single player element to it, or is it, do you have to play it online?
There's both. You have a single player proper campaign, and then when you go online, there's a very wide variety of missions, and there's also a mission maker, so that you can, you know, create your own, well, you can't create your own maps, but you can modify the existing maps and create your own missions to go inside them.
Ah, nice. That sounds pretty good. I had heard of Arma 2, and then when DayZ came out, I got really interested in it, but my internet connection is such that it's not even worth trying to play a game I can only play online. It'd be pointless.
Yeah, it's, you know, it has its own very hardcore fan base. You know, it might be a little alienating to people who've never tried them before, but, you know, if you jump in, you stick with the single-player material for a while until you learn what you're doing, and then you can try, you know, playing some of the mods or the online modes, or, you know, try DayZ. And, you know, if you go to the DayZ website, they have a counter there showing you the average lifespan of the player, and when I first started doing it a year ago, it was something like less than an hour, and you know, people, it's just now slightly over an hour, and so, you know, people have not learned to survive well in this game.
Well, what else do you have? I feel like you've been playing games for, what, like 2 months now, it seems like, since you've been on.
Yeah, it's been a while since I've been on. I went through Alice Madness Returns. That's a game that came out a few years ago. I played a little of it when it first came out, then it's just been sitting on my shelf for years.
How did you like that game? I know I really enjoyed the first Alice, and then I replayed it on the console and was like, eesh, this game is not as good as I remember. The controls were a little awkward. But I thought Madness Returns was pretty good.
Well, I played the original Alice when it first came out, must have been 13 years ago, and at that time, just about every game that came out was either based on the Quake 3 engine or the Unreal Tournament engine, and so, you know, even if you were playing a third-person game, they still all controlled like they were first-person shooters, so people were trying to fiddle with the game engines to make them do things they're not supposed to do, and, you know, the original Alice, it was technically a blend of melee and projectile combat and a little bit of jumping as well, but it didn't really suit the technology that they were trying to put it on. So that game, it looked great, it had a brilliant premise, but it just didn't play well. And with Madness Returns, you know, they're doing it on a different engine. You know, they've deliberately built it around the jumping puzzles, and they have a more action-centric control scheme. So this one, you know, I think it plays competently. It's not remarkable in terms of gameplay mechanics, but it looks amazing in terms of the visual design, and also the voice acting is terrific. You really do, you know, feel like this is a game that you're playing to experience the story and the world. And then, you know, the gameplay itself, the jumping and slashing, that's more something to be tolerated while you find out what's going to happen to Alice on the next level.
I think the thing that kind of disappointed me the most with Madness Returns was the fact that it seemed like a lot of the enemies and even some of the levels, it was more about, I mean, it fit the story because it was more about the damage in her mind, essentially, but a lot of times it was like, well, there isn't even a Wonderland thing going on here. I'm just fighting creepy baby dolls that are possessed in a, like, a giant dollhouse section or something. I mean, it was still a pretty good game and everything, but I was like, I just want to see crazy versions of Wonderland all the time.
Well, the reason that they would deviate from standard Wonderland characters was they were keeping up a Victoriana theme. So even if it's not something specifically mentioned in the books, you would still see, you know, these creepy porcelain dolls, like you mentioned. And, you know, that's something that was very prominent in the late 19th century. So when you have these, you know, monstrous, gooey, tar beasts that have little doll parts sticking out all over them, you know, it's creepy and it suits the time period.
Yeah, for sure. That, the more I think about it, the more I think I should play that game again, just because I remember it looking really good.
Yeah, it wasn't the best in terms of like the high-quality graphics or, you know, the resolution or the textures, but the overall design behind it was was amazing. You know, so even though it's not, you know, a cutting-edge graphical game, it still looks amazing just because of the concepts behind it. And because of that, it's held up well over the last few years.
And not a lot of other games give you the opportunity to shoot a teapot mortar. So if you're looking for that sort of experience, there's really only one place to get it, as far as I know.
Yeah, and one of the collectible items that you can get, you shoot a pepper grinder and shoot it into disembodied pig snouts that fly around. So that's, you know, so if you want to run around with a big pepper grinder blasting pepper into pig noses, and bear in mind, these are severed pig noses with wings that fly around on their own. They're not actually attached to pigs. Then that's something you can do in Alice. I also have to emphasize, it's a really pretty game. Every time Alice goes to a new level, she gets a new outfit, some new cute goth Lolita outfit you can run around in. So, you know, if you just like having a main character that looks adorable, try Alice.
Awesome. What else do you have, Charles?
Well, I've also been playing Neverwinter.
Ooh, I've been waiting to hear about your take on this.
Alright, well, I am a huge fan of Dick Studios from way back when they did City of Heroes, and every time they release some new game, I keep wondering, you know, is this the thing that's going to suck me in the way that City of Heroes did? So, with Neverwinter, you can see in the archetypes, the influences of the original City of Heroes developers, that the kind of character classes that they're using are very similar in terms of the role of what the original five archetypes did for City of Heroes. There's a character that's, you know, there to provide defense, a character that directly attacks enemies in melee, another character that, you know, strikes from a distance, and then, you know, defense and controllers. So if you enjoyed the tactical teamed-ups of City of Heroes, you can get that same experience in the new game, even though it's done with Dungeons & Dragons aesthetics.
So I had asked on Twitter, how is the combat system compared to something like Warcraft?
Well, as we were speaking earlier, that everybody's trying to get away from that World of Warcraft mentality. And so Neverwinter is trying to put a little more action into it. Instead of tapping the one button for the power assigned to one in your little button bar, you now just hold down the mouse button to launch your basic attack. And then you have a secondary attack that you launch by holding down the mouse 2 button. And you also have a handful of keys over by WASD so that you can trigger special, more powerful attacks that have a longer charge up. And as you go through the game, you'll find it plays in some ways like the traditional World of Warcraft with, you know, your basic attack, but it's still focused a little more on using reflexes. And also, you don't lock on to characters as easily. You have to aim with your mouse to launch your attacks. And that kind of makes it a little more reflex-oriented than just that cerebral math attitude of World of Warcraft.
Just that small change seems like it might be enough for people to go, okay, I feel like I'm actively participating in a game again, instead of just watching a video about my character defeat this boss.
Well, it has a few other things going for it as well. One is that it's a free-to-play game, and there's a lot of content that you can get just for free. It's not, you know, it's not a pay-to-win so far. And also, it's a Dungeons & Dragons game, so they're really trying to incorporate as much as they can from the proper Dungeons & Dragons world, so that it feels like you're really in the Forgotten Realms, rather than just a generic fantasy universe.
Have you fought any Beholders? That's an important question.
I have not fought a Beholder yet. I'm terrified of the day that I might have to fight a Beholder or a Mind Flayer.
I'll be interested to hear you come on the show and complain about them when that time comes.
Yeah, I got my brain sucked out this week. You see, that should be the tag for this podcast.
Yeah, no kidding. So is this a game you will continue to play as, you know, moving forward? Will you stick with it and maybe spend some money on it?
This is the one that I'm going to stick with, and yeah, I want to Yeah, when it comes to premium games and free-to-play games, I don't really look at it in the sense of buying the content for the value of the content. I look at it from the point of view of rewarding the developers. And so if I buy, $5 worth of stuff for this game, Zen, little gold coins called Zen are the in-game premium currency. But if I buy $5 worth of Zen, it's going to be because I like the developers and want them to keep making the game.
Right. I think that's a pretty good attitude to have, actually, without instead of just being like, oh, I'm only gonna pay money if there's something great. It's like, well, if you're gonna play the game for 200 hours, I mean, hand over a $5 bill, do something. They spent a lot of time and money on this thing.
Yeah, when you see game developers talking about monetization, they talk about everything except the honor system. And that's something that game developers really need to start looking at. That if they just approach the customer with the mentality of, you give us money that you don't have to give us, and we'll keep making cool games.
This seems like it could be a great topic for an opinion piece, Charles. I want to see it written up.
Yes, sir! I'll get right on that.
I have no authority to do that, but I'm just saying. Now that we're doing fantastic opinion pieces starting soon at GamesReviews.com, I think that would be an interesting one. That's all I'm saying.
Well, since we were just talking about the honor system, I'm now on the honor system. Honor bound to write for you an article about using the honor system for payment.
Nice. And I will absolutely tell them to pay you the going rate that they would pay you whether I told them to or not.
Well, speaking of our honor system, it's sort of like the opposite of crowdfunding. When you have a developer that puts their game on Kickstarter and the audience just buys it in advance before it's even been made, they're essentially, putting the developer on the honor system where, you're now bound to make a really good game for us. And if they do the exact opposite with free-to-pay games, then, you can see maybe more polite player bases, that people who are all there to have fun, who have now invested voluntarily in this game for their community.
I feel like both of those models are very exciting to me. I like the idea of being able to just try out a game for free, especially in an age where there's a lot of good stuff coming to PC that's free to play, but I'm never 100% sure if my computer is going to run it. I love just being able to try it and go, okay, this works. Maybe I'll spend some money on it. Or no, it obviously doesn't work. I'll try it again someday when I have a computer that's not terrible. But I really like the idea of some of the games. I think we've talked before about like Wasteland 2 and stuff that they're making through Kickstarter. These like bigger games that they need a lot of money, or that they need to have the cash up front to make this huge, awesome experience. I don't know. They both excite me a lot.
Yeah, I agree. I'm running a Kickstarter for my the play that I'm doing next month, which is probably already going to be up over by the time people hear this. But come see my play, even though you probably can't donate to my Kickstarter. But I'm using Kickstarter to fund this play that I'm doing, and now I have this compulsion to feel like I've got to make a really, really good show because these people have given me the money in advance to do it. And the sense of, again, being on the honor system, that it's got to be good because people want it to be good. I hope that's motivating people that are doing their games through crowdfunding like Kickstarter.
Yeah, that seems like the pressure there would be intense to have already have people paid for the game. Basically, they gave you the money and said, okay, we want you to make this game, and then you have to deliver it and, pay off their expectations for it. I feel like that'd be a tough situation, but when it works, I think it will work really well.
Yeah, and it's also a better motivation than just having some faceless corporate sponsors, or having some publisher that threw a bunch of money at you and forced you to sign a contract. So, if you're dealing with your customers directly rather than, the heartless investment conglomerate.
Definitely. And in a lot of cases, I feel like they get the games a little cheaper if you pay the Kickstarter amount, whatever the tier is. I think often you can get the game a little cheaper than if you were just buying a game that some publisher or whatever had paid for and then sent to retail.
Yeah, that's very common that, if you take a game that would hypothetically sell for $25, you'll be able to buy in at a $20 point. And that also happens with some other games that do go to retail, where, if you buy in Arma Arma 3, for example. If you buy Arma 3 during the alpha stage, you can get it at a big discount over the initial launch price. And there's a few other companies that have done things like that, where you can buy into, you know, an MMO at a big discount as long as you, you know, do it, you know, a year in advance before the game comes out.
The whole release an alpha and have people pay for it and then the price increases as it goes. I think of it as the Minecraft model because that was the first time I became aware of it. It may have been going on before that. But that's the same model that the guys at Sandswept Studios use for The Dead Linger, which is a game I've talked about on probably the past two or three shows. And quickly, before we get on to your next thing or whatever, I want to mention so I don't forget that on the next episode of the Gamer Studio, I will be interviewing Jeff Keen, who is the CEO and design director for Sandswept Studios, working on The Dead Linger. So that's going to be very exciting.
I'll be listening live when you record it.
Just sneak in the room.
Indeed.
Well, do you mind if I steal it and talk about a couple little things here?
Absolutely. Absolutely not. I mean, yes, no, I don't mind. Mind, I do not. In the absolute.
Well, first of all, in sort of keeping with the Animal Crossing spirit that we started earlier, The Simpsons tapped out. Thanks for getting me addicted to that, by the way. Will it make you uncomfortable on air if I ask you how much money you've spent on this game? Because I see your town. I've gone to your town. We're like Springfield buddies or whatever. I assumed when I saw it that you had like a degree in city planning because it looks great. But I notice a lot of premium buildings on there, Charles.
Well, speaking of the honor system, I started playing that game about a year ago, and right when I got it, I thought, you know, I enjoy this enough that I will give the developers $5 just because they made a thing I like. And then as it went on, I realized I was playing this game every day for it's been about 9 months now. Maybe even longer than that. And every few months, I'll buy another, you know, maybe $10 worth of premium stuff. And altogether, I put in maybe $40 for premium content for this game over the last 9 months. And, you know, that goes back to the honor system of, you know, I know that in order for them to keep putting in the updates and keep the community running, they need somebody to be buying their horribly overpriced donuts. And for people who don't play the game, the in-game currency are called donuts. You know, that's a little Homer Simpsons reference. And, you know, the content tends to be just drastically overpriced, where you'd have to be crazy to spend $10 to get Professor Frink's laboratory. But if you're looking at it from the perspective of you're helping to fund the game directly with your premium currency, then suddenly it becomes a better idea, and you can feel a little more sane in forking out the money for it.
Right. I look at the prices of some of the things, and it's like, that would be so cool to have, and then I compare that to the amount of money I would have to spend in order to get the donuts for it, and I think, oh boy, I don't know that I'm gonna go ahead and do that at the moment. Over time, I will probably build up a nice little stock of donuts as I spend a few dollars here and there. Actually, talking about this game has just reminded me that I forgot to set all my people to their tasks and complete their quests that I put them on before bed last night, which has just frustrated me.
You, sir, are an addict. But getting back to my my degree in city planning, if you take one of these casual city building games like The Simpsons or like Animal Crossing, and you put more hardcore video game player mentality to it, you can kind of use this system to get the most efficient use of your time, and you can avoid being someone that just sits there constantly playing with this stupid game. I've just recently rebuilt my Simpsons town so that it'll take up less of my time and I can still keep it running efficiently. And I actually have the secret shame that I destroyed my Animal Crossing town and rebuilt it from the beginning just yesterday because I didn't think that it would grow into the best possible town with my original choices.
I think that's hardcore city design there. I'm a little embarrassed to say that I want to buy things in The Simpsons so bad that I found out about a tactic that they refer to as house farming on the boards. So I just started doing that, which is where you build loads of purple houses in columns and rows. They don't have to look good or anything, and then they just sit there and generate money that you take, and then after a while of collecting loads and loads of money from all these stupid houses, you just delete them or put them in storage and then build a town that looks good from all the money you've made.
Well, the real hardcore players, they would build a bunch of cheap towns. I mean, build a bunch of cheap buildings. You get a little bit of experience for building each building, and then destroy them and build them over again in the exact same way, and just do that over and over every day, essentially farming experience points.
I feel like that would be too time intensive for me. That might be beyond my ability to obsess about this.
And for those of you who are listening who are really obsessed with the Simpsons Tapped Out, you can use that technique so that once you hit the level cap, you'll be able to essentially farm donuts by leveling up over and over and over again, and that's how you get free premium currency.
Nice. I feel like I'm probably like 6 months or more away from the level cap at this point. The cap is like 30. I think I'm like 13. I've been playing for a while.
Well, farm houses, my friend. Farm those houses and save your donuts.
What else have I been doing? I finished The Last of Us. Have you had a chance to play Last of Us at all?
I have not. Do tell me about it.
I was a little down on it, having played only about the first third when I last spoke about it. But after the first third, it starts to ramp up, and it never really stops. It becomes quite a good game. I still don't necessarily think that it is a 10, or that it warrants all of the 10s that it got, because there are just some expectations I had based on things they said about the game beforehand that I didn't really feel like paid out necessarily. The one I keep mentioning is the fact how they talked about that when you kill somebody, there's going to be like an emotional component to it. You're not going to have to kill people that often, and when you do, you might feel bad about it because they're just regular people. But the very first thing you do in that game, after the brilliant like 15-minute intro, is you take Joel and you go murder about 30 people just because. So it's like, well, all right. As I said before, every character in this game is just immediately aggro. They're just like a post-apocalypse gangster who's out to murder you. So there are not many times you are ever going to feel bad about killing people in this game. I will say there is at least once in the game where I felt bad about it. So, I mean, I guess technically it's true. I felt bad about it once. All the other times I killed people, it was just like any other game. There's a guy in my way of getting to the next room. He's going to die now.
Yeah, there's an older game called I Am Alive, which is also post-apocalyptic. No mutants or zombies or anything, just a regular human apocalypse. And in that, you come across random people that aren't aggroed, but can be if you treat them in the wrong way. And other groups will just be permanently aggroed. So as you go through the world, you have to conduct yourself in a way that you won't antagonize people that might leave you alone. And you also have very limited ammunition. So, sometimes you'll have just one bullet or no bullets at all in your gun. In I Am Alive, you really do have the sense of you don't want to start trouble, and you have a very clear sense that if you end up killing someone, they could be innocent, and it could really be your fault. And so if you're looking for that sort of emotional component to a game, I Am Alive, it's not a great game, but it's an okay game, and that's probably the most interesting aspect of it, in that, you can point your gun and try to ward off people without actually having to, to murder everybody you come across.
Yeah, that sort of thing is what I basically expected from The Last of Us, and it didn't really do that. I know I had mentioned on a different show that I thought from the E3 demo years ago, when they were, just showing how great this game is going to be, they showed Joel pull a gun, and the people reacted like, okay, we just have melee weapons, he's got a gun, maybe we need to think about this or whatever. But I tried that exact situation in the game multiple times, and it didn't matter. They were advancing on me with baseball bats. I pulled a gun and pointed at them. They acted like they didn't notice or care. They just kept coming with the bats, so they got shot in the brain. The end. But we are going to do a special about that when a few more people have played and finished it, similar to what we did with Bioshock. But I feel like this is a game that is sort of, I hate to say that it's limited by being a video game, because it's, especially with the storyline stuff, it's the interactivity that makes it as powerful as it is at the points where it is quite a powerful story. But then there are other things about it that you can't really get away from. Like, I sort of felt like by the end of the game, I was supposed to think back on all the people I had killed and think, okay, maybe some of them weren't bad people and I was the aggressor. But being a video game, I know that that wasn't the case. Like, if they had seen me, they would have tried to kill me, regardless of what the game wants me to think about it. I know that that is a fact, because that's a limitation of the design. So, I don't know. I think it'll be interesting when we have a couple people to sit down and talk about it, because there's going to be a range of opinions on it, even just within the site.
Yeah, sometimes when you're playing a game, you can get the sense that, this sequence was triggered and was going to happen no matter what my choice was, and this is just the game designer screwing around with me. And, you know, when you can see, when you can look at a game and understand what the people making it were trying to do and see their manipulations, that kind of pulls you out of the emotional impact of the story.
Yeah, it really does. I think The Last of Us is Naughty Dog at its best, really. But I sort of think as I get older, I'm moving past the whole go through a section and you get a cutscene as your reward style of play. I want to make my own story, or I want to infer from the design of the levels, or even from, like, with Bioshock, you've got the little audio logs and stuff. I don't need to be told everything in the form of a movie. I would rather be able to infer some things on my own, I think.
Yeah, that's the classic design scheme of, you know, giving the player the amnesiac protagonist who doesn't know anything and meets all these mysterious characters, and only by playing through and solving the puzzle, killing the boss, do you get the cutscene that explains what the hell you just did.
Right. I know that Amnesia: The Dark Descent is a horror game for PC, and I've not finished it, but I have enjoyed every minute I played of it. Has, like, the best opening ever, because you basically just wake up and you find a note that you wrote to yourself saying, I did something to give myself amnesia, don't question it, just go to the basement of this castle you're in and kill the guy that's there. And that's pretty much all the direction you have. You find little notes that you wrote to yourself as you go, but that game is terrifying and fantastic if you're looking for a scary PC game with an interesting little story that isn't necessarily ham-handed.
Yes, it's a terrific old game, and it does have the best use of the waking up with amnesia hero that I've seen in any game.
I guess when it's in the title, you'd better hope that that's the case, right? You will be glad to hear that I started playing Minerva's Den just a day or two ago.
Awesome. What do you think? Well, for those of you who don't know, Minerva's Den is the DLC pack, the story-based DLC pack for Bioshock 2, and something I'm constantly raving about.
Yeah, it came highly recommended by Charles, and then Allison, another guest from the show, had mentioned it at one point independently of that, so I thought, you know, I have it. I just finished The Last of Us. I don't really have anything else going on at the moment. I'm going to play it. It's probably only a couple hours long, I assume. And I like it a lot from what I have played so far. I just got through the first sort of section. I'm down to the operations room or whatever, which is like the second chunk of level or whatever. And I am enjoying it, especially the gravity well plasmid. I have endless fun just throwing this little ball that basically becomes a tiny black hole and sucks people and items into it. And then at the point I've upgraded it to now, it then explodes and throws acid all over them. Just hilarious.
Yeah, that's one of the handful of new features that was added to the game with the DLC. And there's also story-based and puzzle-based uses for that item as well.
Yeah, it's interesting to see some of the new stuff they've added. I just expected them to take this, you know, the same items and plasmids and stuff from the main game, but they really didn't, and it's I'm glad they didn't, because some of the things they've come up with, like that gravity well, as I said, or there's the sort of ion laser cannon thing that you carry. You're a different Big Daddy. I think you're Sigma in this one, and that laser is great as well. I use that for basically everything.
Yeah, that's a little throwback to the chemical sprayer from the first game. And another really cool thing that they do with Minerva's Den is they start you out with really bad plasmids. In the other games, they usually start you out with very powerful abilities like lightning and fire and ice. And in Minerva's Den, it's assumed that you're already an experienced player. So, they give you control over the security machines and a couple of other just crappy powers before you can finally blast someone, with lightning or fire.
Yeah, I think it started me with telekinesis or something, and it was like, this is not something I ever used in the main game unless there was a puzzle where I absolutely had to. It was just a plasmid that was there.
Yeah, for people who haven't played the original BioShock yet, whoever you are, the telekinesis plasmid actually is incredibly useful in terms of defense. So if you're a player that likes to just hammer things with your fireballs and machine guns, you're not going to get much use out of it. But if you use it for capturing enemy projectiles and shooting them back, then it's suddenly this really useful ability.
Yeah, I seem to remember it being pretty good for guys who would throw grenades at you. You could just grab them out of the air and toss them back. But I'm a fireball and machine gun guy, so it rarely found a place in my rotation. I have also been playing Don't Starve, which is a PC game. I don't think it's on anything but PC yet, but it's made by Clay, I think is how you say that. I'm not 100% sure. They're the guys who made Shank and Mark of the Ninja. And in my opinion, Don't Starve is their best game. I wasn't huge into Shank, and for some reason, everybody raved about Mark of the Ninja, but from what I've played of it, I just can't really get into it for some reason. But Don't Starve is a game basically about survival. You just wake up in a strange place, and there's some mysterious man who says, "Hey, you better find something to eat before you starve," and then he disappears, and that's it. And then you just go around gathering items and combining those items to craft things, and then over time you need to, build bigger and better things and set up a little base camp. You start with nothing, and if you're playing well, a few game weeks later, you've got a little base, you're decked out in armor with farms running, and you've got frogs hanging on a drying rack to be turned into frog jerky, and it's really good. You have to make sure you don't go crazy. You have to make sure you don't starve to death. You have to always have a light source because if it gets too dark, which obviously there's a day and night cycle that changes depending on the season, which is pretty neat. If it gets completely dark, there's a mysterious monster waiting in the darkness who will come and attack you and can pretty much kill you in just a few hits. So you have to build a little campfire before night and try not to stray outside the bounds of the light that it provides. And there's loads of monsters everywhere. Some of them are pretty tough. You want to kill them to get their, sort of higher level materials to make the cool things that you can make out of them. But if you get killed, that's it. Apart from finding a touchstone or building this little artifact called a meat effigy, once you die, it deletes your character and the world you are playing in. Death is permanent, apart from, like I said, those two little things that'll bring you back. So you have to play pretty carefully. And that game will absolutely kill you before too long, especially when you're just starting out.
Well, you said the two magic words, and that's frog jerky, so I'm sold on this.
I knew I could get you somewhere in there. There was going to be something that did it. I didn't expect it to be frog jerky.
Remind me to tell you about some of my days in the Cub Scouts. Frog jerky saved my life.
If you really like games about survival, I had said that they referred to Last of Us as a survival game, and I didn't really find that to be the case because if you die, there was no real penalty for it. If you're going to call yourself a survival game, I feel like there should be a consequence for not surviving, and I would say losing everything you have worked for is a pretty good consequence of not surviving. So, Don't Starve is pretty good. The only sort of problem I can see it having is, if you get really good at that game to the point where you're lasting like 60 days or longer, I think the longest I've done is like 20 days before I froze to death when winter came because I didn't know it was coming and I didn't prepare for it properly.
How much real time goes by for 20 days or 60 days?
Every day is 8 minutes of real life time. So if you've played for 10 days, you've played for 80 minutes. And if you were really good at the game, that's kind of the problem, is starting over again every single time, I mean, you're going to have to play for a good couple of hours that you can't just somehow fast forward through before it starts to get challenging and interesting for you again. I have not gotten to that point. It's still interesting to me at the beginning because I can die in 2 minutes if I make a stupid mistake. But I could see that being an issue as I got better at the game.
Wow, so that's like a tougher, manlier version of Animal Crossing then.
A little bit, yeah. You're just building your little place, trying to survive, and then everything in the entire world is basically trying to kill you and ruin everything you've done.
Yeah, that's a complete polar opposite of what's going on in Animal Crossing. But you're still catching frogs. Just in Animal Crossing, you either put them in your home as a pet or give them to a museum that has a zoo in it.
No frog jerky, then. That's a shame.
Yes, now that I think about it, the entire Animal Crossing universe is all vegetarian.
Of course they are. The anthropomorphized animals don't usually want a spot of bacon. Can you punch any of them, like in Xenoclash 2?
No, there's no combat in Animal Crossing at all. The closest thing you have is that you get a slingshot, and every now and then a balloon with a gift box will float over the city, and you have to chase it around and shoot it with your slingshot. You do get an axe, but you don't have the opportunity to go axe crazy with it.
Maybe that's a special unlockable feature when you've played long enough.
Yeah, it's just for deforestation, but eventually, you know, you'll come to a point where after you've played the same game from the same town for 10 years, you will go axe crazy and just murder the other villagers. Or at least that's what I read on this internet.
Well, I think that's basically all I have been playing, and basically all that I have time for this week.
All right, cool. We'll do it again next week, and I want to talk about Fable 3, which I suddenly realize I've been playing on Xbox now that it's free, and we should talk about the free Xbox games.
Definitely. All right, that is next week. Free Xbox games, copying PlayStation Plus.
All right, cool.
All right, I guess that is it from us. Make sure if you want to send us any emails, you can do that at podcast@gamesreviews.com. We'll answer your questions or comments on the air, unless you're just telling me what a jerk I am. I'll still read it on the air. I promise you that. If you want to follow me on Twitter, it's @Joe_Ryan150. And Charles, what's your Twitter? Give it to him.
I'm Charles Battersby, and for those of you who know how to spell my name, there's no Y on the end of it on my Twitter handle.
Excellent. All right. I look forward to the Gamers Studio with Jeff Keane from Sandswept Studios. That'll be out sometime in the next probably week or two. We're going to do a whole day of preview coverage on the Dead Linger, but it should be exciting. Charles, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
All right. And with that, we are out.